It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
you are denied a discharge, and it becomes a real problem because when you are denied a discharge in that new bankruptcy, all of the debt for which you are denied a discharge under those circumstances are never dischargeable in a Chapter 7.
Private attorney and friend of the show, Jason Crumbine at Crumbine Consumer Legal Services, reveals the many pitfalls of filing a do-it-yourself bankruptcy in the second part of a two-part interview. And during this week's News You Can Use, we discuss the need for an immediate crackdown on bank payday lending as an inherently dangerous product. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 156, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Center for Responsible Lending is writing to four federal bank regulators, urging them to take immediate action to stop banks from making unaffordable, high-cost payday loans. Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, Fifth Third, Regions, and Guaranty Bank's deposit advance loans are structured just like loans from payday loan storefronts, carrying a high cost combined with a short-term balloon repayment. These loans trap borrowers in a cycle of expensive long-term debt, causing serious financial harm to borrowers, including increased likelihood of bankruptcy, paying credit card debts and other bills late, delayed medical care, and loss of basic banking privileges because of repeated overdrafts. Payday lending by banks undermines state laws that have prohibited or imposed meaningful restrictions on payday loans in recent years. It also undermines provisions of the Military Lending Act aimed at protecting service members from payday loans. For customers with direct deposit of wages or public benefits, the banks will lend money in increments for a fee ranging from $7.50 to $10 per $100 borrowed. The bank deposits the loan amount directly into the customer's account and then repays itself the loan amount plus the fee directly from the customer's next incoming direct deposit. If direct deposits are not sufficient to repay the loan within 35 days, the bank repays itself anyway, even if the repayment overdraws the consumer's account, triggering more costs through overdraft fees. Payday borrowers routinely find themselves unable to repay the loan in full, plus meet their expenses for the next month, without taking out another payday loan. A recent analysis of actual checking account activities by the Center for Responsible Lending finds the same is true with bank payday loans. Bank payday loans typically carry an annual percentage rate of 365% per year. On average, bank payday borrowers are in debt for 175 days per year. Many bank payday borrowers are Social Security recipients, and the banks take significant portions of their monthly checks immediately for repayment of bank payday loans. Just as with other payday loans, protections such as installment options and cooling off periods simply do not stop the cycle of repeat loans. Ultimately, bank payday loans erode the assets of bank customers and, rather than promote savings, make checking accounts unsafe for many customers. The regulators are urged to stop allowing banks currently making payday loans from offering this inherently dangerous product. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Bristow versus Bristow. After 11 months of marriage, Louis Bristow filed for a fault-based divorce in 1970. His wife, Jane Bristow, countersued for a fault-based divorce. 7 years later, after neither party proved fault, the City of Newport News Circuit Court granted a no-fault divorce, but did not award any spousal support due to the short duration of the marriage. The wife appealed, and the Supreme Court of Virginia reversed. The Supreme Court held that although spousal support is discretionary, to exercise its discretion, the court must consider all of the factors listed in the Code of Virginia. These include not only the duration of the marriage, but also the earning capacity, obligations, needs, financial resources, education, training, age, and physical and mental conditions of the parties. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Bristow versus Bristow is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
If your finances are bad enough so you need a bankruptcy, your abilities may not be good enough to file it on your own. Here's the second part of a two-part interview with private attorney Jason Crumbine at Crumbine Consumer Legal Services about the many pitfalls of filing a do-it-yourself bankruptcy. Another problem that people have is they may not understand how long they have to wait between filing bankruptcies. What are the waiting periods and what is the consequence of not waiting the proper period?
The time from filing one Chapter 7 to filing another Chapter 7 is 8 years. If the last bankruptcy was a Chapter 7 and I want to file a Chapter 13, how long do you have to wait? That's 4 years. If the last bankruptcy was a Chapter 13 and I want to file another Chapter 13, how long do you have to wait? That one's 2 years.
And if you don't wait the proper period, what happens?
You are denied a discharge. And it becomes a real problem because when you are denied a discharge in that new bankruptcy, all of the debt for which you are denied a discharge under those circumstances are never dischargeable in a Chapter 7.
You discussed earlier Chapter 7s and Chapter 13s, and I gather that some people can file a 7 and other people can only file a Chapter 13. Can you explain that difference and what's the consequence of filing the wrong chapter?
The difference between a Chapter 7 and a Chapter 13 is that you must make a payment plan in a Chapter 13, and in a Chapter 7, you don't. You are essentially liquidated. Now, in most Chapter 7s, liquidations, creditors receive nothing out of your liquidation because that's what would happen in your situation. In a Chapter 13, they are going to get something. Now, the question of why a person would be forced to file a Chapter 13 as opposed to being forced to file a Chapter 7 is a somewhat complex answer. And there are three major factors in deciding that. The first is a test devised by Congress called the means test. The means test is an analysis of your income that determines whether or not they think, not you think, but they think that you should be able to afford to pay your creditors something. If the numbers, and it's an objective test, if the numbers show that you can afford to pay your creditors something, then you must file a Chapter 13. You are not eligible to file a Chapter 7. Now, the key factor there is how much income do you have? And the related question is, how does that compare to the median income or average income for Virginians? The next question is, when you look at your budget, when you compare your monthly income your paychecks and you compare it to your monthly expenses, is there any money left over? Would there be enough money left over to pay your creditors at least $100 per month? And that's a much harder question because that's a somewhat subjective analysis. And it comes in part to the question of what expenses are you engaging in that are reasonable? Like, for example, if a single person said that their food budget was $1,000 a month, that would likely draw an objection by the trustee and result in the trustee moving to dismiss the bankruptcy or moving to convert you to a Chapter 13, which would be something that's not likely to be making you happy. On the other hand, a family of five feeding five people for $1,000 a month is actually about a fair budget.
So it's not a clear bright line test of you're below the state median or average income, you can file a 7. You still could be forced into a 13 based upon your budget, your income, and your expenses.
That's correct. And then there's the third factor, which is a factor that I actually see more commonly, and that is there some unprotected equity in something, and we discussed equity, that would be something that you would want to keep. For example, the $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of value in your house that would be not protected from a Chapter 7 trustee. In that circumstance, you would need to file a Chapter 13 to protect the equity. Or it might be that you want to look at some sort of bankruptcy alternative, which is much harder and much more long and drawn out.
Now, both before people file a bankruptcy and after people file the bankruptcy, but before they get the discharge, people have to do something called consumer credit counseling. And I gather there are pitfalls involved with that as well. What are those pitfalls?
The first one, the one that you have to take before bankruptcy, is called consumer credit counseling. That must be taken within 180 days of the filing of your bankruptcy. Some people are confused and think that you have to take the class and wait 180 days, 6 months, and then they end up having to take the class a second time when they go see a lawyer. The second class is the class that you take after bankruptcy. That's called personal financial management or debtor education. That one must be taken after you have filed for bankruptcy. You have to have a bankruptcy case number in order to take the class. And you must file that certificate with the court within a short period of time after your bankruptcy is filed. Typically, that period of time is 45 days after the meeting of creditors.
And the meeting of creditors is usually how soon after you have filed the bankruptcy?
30 to 45 days after the bankruptcy was filed.
So basically, within 3 months of filing, you better also file this certificate of personal financial counseling.
Yes, that's correct.
And if not, what happens?
You don't get a discharge. Now, that one's not quite so bad because it's not that you were denied a discharge, your case is just simply closed without a discharge.
Now, I gather another thing that can result in your bankruptcy case being closed without a discharge has to do with the filing fees. A lot of people try to pay the filing fees in some sort of installment plan. What happens there if they don't make the installment plan?
If they don't make the installment plan payments, normally what happens is that the bankruptcy is dismissed. But that's one of the ones that's hard to really specifically point to because usually, but not every time, the clerks are okay with a day or two late. By a week or so, they start not being able to accept the late payment. Now, the fee for the filing of a bankruptcy for a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is $306. If you have a situation where you really can't afford to pay the $306 for the filing of your bankruptcy, paying your filing fee in installments isn't necessarily a good choice. Sometimes the better choice is to come up with a financial plan that will enable you to not pay certain debts in order to save up that $306 to pay the filing fee.
Now, of course, there is a procedure that allows really low-income people to ask the bankruptcy court to file a bankruptcy without having to pay a fee at all. Is this something that low-income people should pursue, or is this yet another pitfall that's out there?
this has a potential pitfall, but it's not a horrible pitfall. The problem with this one is that there is now a second hearing that you need to go to that typically is before the meeting of creditors. And that would be a hearing held by the judge to determine whether or not you really don't have the money to be able to afford the filing fee. If the judge determines that you don't, he will order either that you pay the full filing fee immediately, and typically they'll give you a short window, 15, maybe 30 days, or they'll say you have some money but not so much money and will permit you to pay the filing fee in installments. Typically, that gives you somewhere between 60 and 90 days to pay the filing fee. But once again, you now have the installment fee over time, and you have an additional hearing, which is something that is an additional opportunity to have something go wrong.
And things that might go wrong also, it seems to me, is the paperwork that actually accompanies a bankruptcy. It's not just you sign a piece of paper that says, I want to go bankrupt. There are petitions, there are forms, there are schedules. It's at least, from what you've told me in the past, 50 or 60 pages worth. Could you sort of describe what all these petitions, forms, and schedules are and the pitfalls that people could run into if they try to do it themselves?
The list of forms is a fairly long list. In a typical Chapter 7, you'll have the petition, which is actually a relatively simple form. It's basically a statement that you wish to file for bankruptcy with, for example, your Social Security number, your name, your address, other things like that. There will be a set of schedules, and along with the schedules, there is the summary of schedules, and there is a statistical analysis, which is an analysis of your schedules. There are schedules A through J, and there is a separate schedule for real estate that you own, or if you don't own any. There is a separate schedule for your personal property. Now, personal property is everything that you own or might own that is not real estate. That includes everything from the clothes on your back to airplanes to patents to intellectual property. Any of those things are personal property, even though it's not necessarily something you can physically hold, a ball, a skirt, a pair of socks, it's still property that you own. Schedule C is the list of exemptions. This is the one that commonly trips up people who are filing bankruptcies on their own. And the reason why it trips up people who are filing on their own is because it's essentially a blank form. You have to tell them what set of exemptions you wish to apply, and you have to pick the right set of exemptions that apply to your circumstance, and you have to say what provisions of the exemptions apply in your case. What is it that allows you to keep the real estate and all the personal property in your situation? Or maybe you don't want to necessarily keep that. And here's where it gets to be difficult. If you fail to claim the exemptions, if you don't put anything down explaining why all of that stuff is exempt with specificity, you don't get to keep any of it. I'll give you a perfect example. If you put down on your schedules that you own clothing, everybody owns clothing, so you're going to have to put clothing down. You put down on Schedule B that you own clothing. Now, clothing in Virginia is exempt up to a certain dollar amount. If you don't put down on Schedule C that you're exempting the clothing under the appropriate code section, it's not exempt. You lose your clothes.
So you can literally lose the shirt off your back if you don't fill out those schedules properly.
Yes, that is correct. You could lose the shirt off your back. You could lose your car. You could lose your house. You can lose all of your jewelry. You could lose your retirement accounts that are exempt.
Simply because you don't list it properly on the exemption form.
That's correct. Schedules D through F are your creditors. D is secured creditors. E is priority creditors. And F is unsecured creditors. Schedule G is executory contracts. And Schedule H is cosigners and co-debtors. And knowing what an executory contract is and knowing what a co-debtor is important. For example, an executory contract is a contract that has not yet been completed. But, for example, a home loan would not fall under executory contract. It would go under Schedule A for real estate and Schedule D for the loan. Schedules I and J are your income and expenses. Then there is the Statement of Financial Affairs that is a detailed description using words and numbers about what has happened that has caused you to get into this situation. The Statement of Intentions is an explanation to your secured creditors, your mortgage creditors, your car finance companies, the furniture finance companies, about what you intend to do to either pay or surrender or redeem your property. And then, of course, there is the Statement of Monthly Income, the means test. And the means test is, I think I mentioned before, a remarkably difficult form to fill out correctly. It's just designed around confusion.
And what happens to a debtor who misses that first meeting of creditors?
It depends a lot on the circumstances. Under most circumstances, the bankruptcy would be just simply dismissed. You would then have the ability to refile if you so desire, but there are additional hoops to jump through if you choose to do so. If, on the other hand, other circumstances would be apparent, like, for example, if you appeared to have equity for the purposes of bankruptcy, if there was something that a trustee could have taken, you would not receive your discharge. Your bankruptcy would not be dismissed. It might be that there would be a hearing sanctioning you, getting you in trouble. You might be referred to the FBI for bankruptcy fraud. All sorts of things could happen.
I guess the last question is, what happens if you just fail to list a debt after you have filed a bankruptcy?
That is actually a much easier question. In a Chapter 7, where there is no distribution to the unsecured creditors, which is most Chapter 7 bankruptcies, unsecured creditors are discharged anyway. Most of them, not all of them. For example, student loans are not discharged, whether you list them or not. But child support also not discharged. However, a medical bill or a credit card that is accidentally missed would be discharged. It's a little bit fuzzy because if it looks like it was intentionally left out, that debt would be not discharged, and you have potentially committed the crime of bankruptcy fraud, which is one of the reasons, once again, why we recommend seeing a lawyer. One of the things that lawyers do is they do things like looking at credit reports. Now, a credit report won't necessarily list everybody, but it gets us asking the questions to make sure that there isn't somebody out there that's obvious. We want to see your bills. We want to see your credit reports. It enables us to cross-reference and make sure that everybody's there.
Well, Jason, you have given us so many compelling reasons why people really should think and think and think again and not do a do-it-yourself bankruptcy because of all these pitfalls. Thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
I am glad that I could assist. Thank you very much.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 45.1, which deals with mines and mining. Did you know that the governor of Virginia can seize and operate a coal mine? Under Code of Virginia Section 45.1-163.314, when in the judgment of the governor there is an imminent threat of a substantial interruption or there is a substantial interruption of the mining, production and marketing of coal for the purpose of furnishing heat and power to the people of Virginia, he shall proclaim that an emergency exists, and it is the duty of the governor to seize and operate the property of any person used in the mining, production, and marketing of coal that he deems essential for the protection of the welfare, health, and safety of the people of Virginia. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. How can you increase your tax refund by as much as $5,751? And what happens when you get a 1099-C after a creditor writes off a debt? Join us next week when Paul Harrison at the Community Tax Law Project discusses the earned income tax credit, as well as whether forgiveness of debt is taxable income. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.